You're listening to Sex and Politics at savage.love.
Elon Musk, who has proved himself to be such a capable administrator and is definitely someone I would trust with my life, wants to colonize Mars. If you would like to go, Elon is looking for volunteers. And he's not the only visionary billionaire out there talking about establishing permanent human colonies in space, on the moon, rotating space stations. The visionary billionaires are all over it. They claim, these visionaries do, that self-sustaining human colonies in space will be a reality within the next 30 years. You may be wondering, how will people live up there? Where will they find oxygen up there? How will they grow food up there? We know how they'll grow potatoes. We saw how Matt Damon did that in The Martian. But the question almost no one asks, a question I've wondered about, how will people fuck up there? That's just one of the questions Dr. Kelly Wienersmith and Zach Wienersmith ask and answer in their new book, A City on Mars, Can We Settle Space? Should We Settle Space? And Have We Really Thought This Through? Welcome to Sex and Politics. It's our bonus podcast, usually for Magnum Savage Lovecast subscribers exclusively, but we're making this one available to all as a gift to our micro listeners and hopefully an inducement to our micro listeners to become Magnum subs, so you'll never miss an episode of Sex and Politics, on top of getting ad-free Lovecast with more questions and more guests, the extended Savage Love struggle session, invites to Savage Love Live, and more. All right, back to space. Kelly and Zach are very in demand on the podcast circuit right now. Their book is a New York Times bestseller, so I was thrilled when they agreed to demean themselves by coming on Sex and Politics. Our conversation covers a lot of ground, covers a lot of space, but only here do Kelly and Mark tackle the really important question about space colonization that no one else is thinking to ask. Monogamy or polyamory? Which one is going to work better in space? The Wienersmith's answer surprised me. It may surprise you too. I hope you enjoy this installment of Sex and Politics. Kelly and Zach, thank you so much for talking with me today.
We are so excited to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having us. We're super excited.
The first question I like to ask people who co-authored a book is, who did most of the work?
Oh, me. Yeah, definitely.
I'm just going to take the path of nobility here and not engage in this, this sort of thing.
This book was actually really nice 50-50, so we split the research and the writing went back and forth.
How long have you guys been together? And how did you meet? Where are the mixers for cartoonists and bioscientists?
We met back in 2007 on OkCupid, which was free. I think that's why we both ended up on that website. And yeah, it's all been magic.
I was curious if there was some like artist-scientist meet-cute moment, but it was OkCupid. And you were a little ahead of the curve. You know, 2007, most same-sex couples were meeting online, but not as many opposite-sex couples. Now the majority of everybody meets online.
Yep.
So you guys were pioneers in that space, if not pioneers in space.
Trailblazers.
So let's talk about the book. I want to be the first member of the dues-paying LGBTQIA+ community to call out the appalling cis-heterosexism in your New York Times best-selling book, A City on Mars. You write about procreational sex almost exclusively, no mention of recreational sex, on behalf of the we only have recreational sex community. What's up with that?
I don't want to take this to a down note, but of course the societies that launched people to space were profoundly homophobic. So most of the people who went to space to this day were men. I think NASA would still frown upon any kind of hanky-panky between anyone, but I think throughout most of the history of space, recreational sex between, there was not even, you know, the approved sort of sex would have been maybe even legal trouble. I mean, we have pretty robust evidence of space masturbation. I think we can say that's confirmed. But recreational activity is not, and so it remains a big open question. And I actually do think the homophobia is part of the answer to it, because I just don't think the places where it was most possible, where things were a little looser than they are now, were places where it was mostly Soviet men.
Well, you know, an International Space Station with all men is a little bit like a pirate ship or a prison. It is a good opportunity for what's called situational homosexuality.
Yes.
And yet that doesn't come up in your book. And I was trying to put you on, I was trying to put you on the spot. The defense I wanted you to make is you're talking about a city on Mars. You're talking about populating a city on Mars. So of course, procreational sex is what's relevant.
Yes.
The fist fuckers and the gay dudes can figure it out for themselves.
There was a proposal, at least according to one cosmonaut, to send up, the phrase used was rubber woman, and I don't know if that's just the Soviet way of saying it. So there was... The Soviet program is actually kind of weird. Like, you know, Soviet Union was not an open society, but their psychiatry people were much more open. And like an American astronaut, if they were depressed in space, would be kind of reluctant to talk about. Whereas there are Soviets who are just like spilling their guts about it. And his proposal for sending a sex doll up, I don't think it happened. But there was a porn collection on Space Station Mir, the last and greatest Soviet space station. So there was recreational activity, let's say.
And 50 Shades of Grey was sent up, translated into Russian.
Okay, so we know, and you detail in your book how people are jacking off in space. The book, A City on Mars, is about this idea, you know, most sort of promoted by, and the person most obsessed with it seems to be Elon Musk, creating colonies on space, an Earth 2, a plan B in case things continue to get worse here. And I don't know how things are going to get better here. And for that to happen, it has to be a self-sustaining, reproducing population of humans in space. And your book is, I don't know how else to describe it, but 400 pages of throwing cold water on that idea.
We've been called relentlessly depressing also, but I, you know, I'd like to point out that we still think it's a neat idea, and maybe we'd like to see it happening generations from now when we figure out a bunch of the problems, but we try to be funny while being downers.
Oh no, the book is hysterical. I laughed my ass off, but you know, we've got, you know, with Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, is we've got these two space-obsessed billionaires talking about having a colony on Mars with 1 million people within the next 30 years. And, you know, my area is sex. So I was most interested in the section of your book on sex. And I am surprised that with all this talk of, you know, creating colonies on Mars, that nobody until you guys came along and wrote this book really thought through whether fucking was going to work, not just fucking, but conception, pregnancy, childbirth. Can you walk us through some of the problems with sex that the space billionaires, as you call them in the New York Times, haven't been thinking about?
Sure. Well, do you mean problems with sex or problems with procreation?
Problems with sex for procreation in space.
In space. Well, so we don't have a lot of relevant data for a variety of reasons. And one of them is that space stations have not been fielded specifically with the goal of preparing us for space settlement. So the International Space Station was not made so that we can try to get the data that we need on reproduction. So you've got a bunch of people up there who are not supposed to be having sex. But even if they could, there would be some difficulties. And, you know, for example, the International Space Station is in free fall, which is essentially like there being no gravity. So, you know, when you go to push against your partner, or thrust against your partner, they're going to get thrown against the opposite wall because of, you know, equal and opposite reactions.
Well, I've been thrown against walls in Berlin. Kind of hot.
They have equal and opposite reactions in Berlin, too.
And no, it can be fun. I don't disagree. But it does make some of the mechanical part, it can make things a little difficult. But there have been some cool proposals. So other people have thought about this. So there is a unchastity belt, which sort of is like a rubber band that holds all comers together. And sort of when you push against each other, the elastic band pulls you back. There's a two-suit, which there's this great video on YouTube. They go up on this parabolic flight. So the idea is you go up really fast and then you go down really fast. And in that downtime, you have 30 seconds of free fall. So like a super fast quickie. And so they rip the Velcro off and try to connect their suits together and they don't get very far. But anyway, this could work in space.
It's a proof of concept.
One of the other options or proposals is a kind of tube that people insert themselves
into. The snuggle tunnel.
What a name.
So the snuggle tunnel is a dicey place to do anything because, so you have to imagine like a large pipe with like holes in it. And the thing about space is because there's no up-down orientation, any of that, like on Earth you breathe and the carbon you breathe out goes away. in space, when like the ventilation system isn't working, which has happened, carbon is just going to pool around your head. So you have to sort of fan it or move around. So the snuggle tunnel, you're going to want to fan at the bottom or something just to add to the appeal of the snuggle tunnel. And it's going to be loud too. Like space stations are loud because they have to be constantly ventilated. So if you imagine like a fan at the bottom, like you're looking down into a fan and then hopefully that's carrying away the various effluents your bodies are generating.
Or if you're into breath play, the buildup of carbon monoxide in the snuggle tunnel could be a selling point.
This is why we need more research, because I would say actually my concern, if you're trying to asphyxiate your partner via atmospherics, you probably give them a headache and carbon narcosis before there's a kind of moment of ecstasy.
Or a moment of conception. And as you detail in the book, that, you know, the fucking is almost the most easily solved problem.
I'm sure we'll figure it out. Yeah.
Procreational sex in space.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, people are masturbating, they're ejaculating. Just like there's airborne human feces on these space stations, yes, and on these spacecraft, which is, those three words are enough to keep me on Earth for the rest of my life. You know, people have jacked off in space. There's airborne semen that perhaps their crewmates have inhaled unknowingly, non-consensually. But the actual ejaculation, the conception, that's the easy part.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What comes next? Why gestation, you know, an infant being born in a weightless environment. Why are these problems, and how come Battlestar Galactica hasn't actually examined them in any depth or detail?
We don't have really great data. And part of the reason we don't have great data is because, you know, folks like Elon Musk are proposing a space settlement on Mars, which is totally different than the conditions on the International Space Station. So one main problem is that the International Space Station is inside of what's called the magnetosphere, which essentially protects us from all of space's radiation, which is different than the kind of radiation we get on Earth. So we understand it even less. So if you're on Mars, which has no magnetosphere, you are going to be exposed to this radiation your entire life. So, you know, women are born with our eggs. Those eggs are going to be exposed to radiation for all of our lives. And then, you know, we'll have babies and they're going to get exposed to radiation. And this accumulation of radiation could cause problems, but we really don't know, because we don't have great data, because the data from the International Space Station isn't super informative. And then additionally, the International Space Station is in free fall, as we've talked about. But Mars is partial gravity, so it's 40% of Earth's gravity, and it's totally unclear if that's going to be enough to solve any problems in development that might depend on gravity. Or, for example, on the International Space Station, you lose about 1% per month of the bone density in your hip. And so 40% of Earth's gravity, you know, I don't know, maybe that eradicates it completely to 0%, or maybe it's 0.1% or something. And over the entire lifetime of a woman, you know, who's born on space and grows up, I would not want to be the first woman who's keeping her fingers crossed and hoping that, you know, my hips don't break in the process of giving birth, because that would be quite unpleasant. And so, yeah, there's just all this stuff we don't have good data on yet.
One of the things I learned reading your book that I thought was so fascinating, and I'm sort of, you know, I'm not completely scientifically illiterate, sort of conscious of or had been aware of, but never really thought through, was how much of an impact gravity has on our bodies, that we are these 2 meter tall columns of water, I think you said in the book, and the downward pressure of gravity, the pressure of the air against our bodies are always kind of working against that pressure and working with gravity. And when you subtract that gravity, or on Mars, more than halve that gravity, that's going to have an impact on our biological systems that over generations, we don't know how to play out.
Yeah. And one thing I want to add to that is, so you often will meet people who will say, you know, oh, well, where there's less gravity on Mars, so we'll get taller. And it's just like, we absolutely don't know that. You know, there's no reason to suppose you can just predict, because biological systems are really complicated. Or you'll get people who think, well, we'll adapt to the radiation or whatever. But you might adapt to, like, whatever toxins are in the atmosphere. Like, you know, we just don't know. Like, there are just tons of open questions, and you can't simply reason through them because they're very biologically complicated.
You describe early in the book Elon Musk as a dynamic tech geek. As you've been working on this book, he seems to have been coming apart. When you began working on this book, he was kind of this visionary genius, still perhaps in your estimation. Now he seems like a crazy cat lady. Where do you guys come down on Elon Musk right now?
So I appreciate that the rockets his company created have reduced the cost of launching things to space. We are coming to you from a Starlink internet connection. We live in the middle of Virginia. This is the best internet connection we can get. So, you know, Starlink and SpaceX are improving our lives in some ways. I appreciate Tesla and the fact that, you know, Tesla has pushed the rest of the automotive industry in the U.S. to start making electric cars. I think that's probably good in the long run. But do I want him leading humans to being interplanetary? Fuck no. He is not the right person for that. That is petrifying. And so I guess that's where I currently fall.
To elaborate, like what the joke I've been telling is like, when we started in 2017, you kind of had to convince people that you don't want Elon Musk to be the mayor of anything. And now you don't. And the kind of big question that with Space Geeks is, you know, the Robert Caro quote, like power doesn't corrupt, but it does reveal. And so the question was, was he always this crazy, or is he, as you say, coming apart? And I tend to favor the some switch is loose now, like something has changed. He seems to have gone into conspiracy land.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of billionaires in general. I don't think they should exist. I think there should be 99.99% taxation after your first billion. But I used to kind of be an Elon fan. Yeah. Like I thought making electric cars sexy, although I think we need fewer cars on the road. We just don't want to replace all the cars with electric cars because then we still have gridlock and pedestrian deaths. We need fewer cars, but like making them sexy and viable was great. And the way he used to talk about solving the solar panel on the roof problem by building a battery wall in your house, and that seems to have just fallen away. I thought that was a great idea, and I was psyched to get a battery wall in my house. Mm-hmm. But the buying of Twitter and the anti-Semitism and the careening around and the lipstick at the panel he was just on where he told Disney to go fuck itself.
That was awesome. That was, like advertisers on my site, go fuck yourselves. It was, 4D chess.
Business genius. That's
enough on Elon. Let's get back to the cold and cruel universe that we live in. You write that the universe wants us dead. Can you explain?
One way I like to say that is if actually even on the surface of the Earth, it's something like 70% of the surface of the Earth, if you're transported to Antarctica, anywhere in the ocean, like much of the surface of the Earth, you are also dead. You're just dead faster in space. And the point is that, you know, humans are evolved for a fairly narrow band of conditions. It maybe doesn't feel that way because there are, you know, people who live in deserts and people who live in the tundra, but that's still quite a narrow band by space standards, right? So it's not just that space is sort of empty and cold or empty and hot or high pressure. It's like also often poisonous, right? And so like the Martian surface is high in a hormone disrupting chemical, which ties back to the question about procreation. So I think people wouldn't normally think there'd be biologically bad stuff, but there's of course tons. It's sort of like space is a giant Superfund site that's also trying to kill you with physics. So it's just that you're evolved, you know, you're an ape, right, from a place. And the rest of the universe doesn't recognize that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the moon is awful. It's a complete vacuum. So you step outside and you're dead. You're also exposed to the radiation, which could kill you in a different way. There's tons of little things coming from space that aren't stopped by an atmosphere like what we have here on Earth. And so they hit you with full force and they could puncture your habitat. Yeah. There's just, and then the moon and Mars are covered with this layer of dirt that isn't like dirt on Earth. It's called regolith and it's made up of all of these little microscopic knives. They're like glass and much sharper than what we typically have down here. So you have to worry about accidentally bringing it into your habitat and breathing it in. There's some folks who argue that we might have to worry about stone grinder's disease, which is essentially when you breathe in too many sharp things that scar your lungs over and over and over again, and then you have trouble breathing. And so there's all of these little problems that add up, and you know, it's really good here.
I'm a fan of life on Earth. Sometimes it seems like the people who talk about colonizing space have this fatalism about the fate of Earth, or the talk of colonizing space is a way of at least psychologically washing your hands of Earth, that we will have strip mined Earth and made Earth uninhabitable, but it's okay because we are going to escape to the moon or rotating space stations, which is Jeff Bezos's obsession because he saw 2001 as a child, as we all did. And that's not really, there is no plan B. Right. There is no backup planet and Mars ain't it, as you unpack in the book. What is, you know, if you could successfully get a city of 1 million people on Mars, a viable culture or society on Mars, what would, you know, we all know, everybody who can hear the sound of my voice is, lives on Earth. We all know what life on Earth is like. What would that life look like? Best case scenario.
Ooh, that's a tough question. We haven't been asked. And so to be honest, we mostly try to confine ourselves to like the earlier stages. So by the time you've got 1 million people, hopefully you've got like specialization. You've got the doctors, you know, the urologist and the mental health professionals. And so you've got a nice division of labor and you've figured stuff out, but you're probably going to be living underground because you have to worry about space radiation. So most of the proposals that we've seen involve taking that horrible dirt that's all jagged and wants to kill you and burying it, your habitat underneath it. So we're going to leave Earth to be like ants on another planet. You know, you're not going to be able to go outside without putting on a spacesuit and breathing pure oxygen for something like 30 minutes to prepare your body, because the 1% atmosphere outside means that when you step out, the nitrogen in your blood is going to bubble out and kill you. And so, you know, it's going to be very inconvenient. But by the time you've got 1 million people, hopefully we've solved some problems. What do you think about 1 million people, Zach?
Well, so the other thing, so yeah, you're almost certainly living underground because on the surface, you know, you get temperature swings, exposure to radiation, and there's hardly any atmosphere if you're on Mars. The other thing, hopefully, and we're talking about the best case scenario, is that you've engineered an Earth-like biosphere, also probably underground. And so this is a big problem we talk about in the book because we don't really know how to do that. The biggest such experiment, meaning a sealed bubble in which an ecosystem is created where the only thing that gets in is like sunlight. The biggest such experiment is Biosphere 2, which you probably remember was made fun of widely in the 90s. But yeah, so that was eight people. Eight people went in, eight people came out. It sort of worked. At one point, however, they were running out of oxygen that had to be piped in, and they were also very hungry by the end, but it did work. Problem is, for 1 million people, you know that you have to scale up by over 100,000 times. We don't even know how to make it work with eight people yet. And the real problem, so it's like, it is just a science question. There is some solution we don't have, but it's going to be a hard solution to get because of the, you know, it's an ecosystem. It's a complicated thing. And so running a giant ecosystem, we don't know how to do it.
And in the vacuum of space, one crack in your giant human underground ant farm habit trail, one crack in one place, everybody's dead.
To ease your mind a little bit, you can actually have, and this freaks me out, like the space station and ISS actually regularly has holes in it that they have leaks that they go find. Yeah, I know. I had the same thing. Like you think from movies, if a little spot goes through it, the whole thing's going to evert or something. But actually, like the system can tolerate little holes. But actually, apparently we were told pretty common on the ISS, there's a leak and everybody drops everything to go find the leak. And the reason that happens is just there's lots of little high speed stuff in space. And so, you know, you can create shields that make that okay because they're like multi-layered and so the it breaks apart the object and blah, blah, blah. But like, yeah, so actually you probably could tolerate some amount of leak, but honestly, it's one of the freakier things to me about space that there is some amount of leaking.
When I think about the first people to arrive at a space station, the first colonists, maybe this would be the only instance in which we can use the word colonist without it having negative connotations, because there's nobody else up there, so far as we know. I always think of Sartre and Hell as Other People. How do you control for, you know, you send 24 people up on a spaceship to Mars to be the first people to begin to build the ant farm for the 1 million who are coming. How do you control for these people not despising each other within a month? And the journey to Mars is what, 3 years?
Yeah, so this is an incredible question. So it's 6 months in presumably a pretty small vessel to get to Mars. Then you have to stay on Mars for at least a year because of orbital mechanics. You have to wait for the Earth to get close enough again. And then it's a 6 month trip back. And, you know, as Zach mentioned biosphere, that was a 2 year trip also. And those eight people split into two hateful factions, which were at one point literally spitting on each other. They hated each other so much. They didn't make eye contact for like a year. And I don't know how you can ensure that people, like, you can fake it for 2 weeks. Like, if you didn't like the guy you were with on the Apollo mission, you can fake it for 2 weeks.
Yes.
But how do you fake it for 2 years? That's really hard. And additionally, you can't, like, call your psychiatrist back at home and be like, screw this guy. Like, how? What, give me the right breathing techniques to make this work. Because as you get closer to Mars, there's going to be at least a 3-minute delay, and as much as a 22-minute delay. So you can't have live time calls with health professionals back home. So, you know, maybe you send the right kind of people who have the right breathing techniques to help you get through this stuff. I don't know.
To be a little cautious how we say this, though, like, so, you know, you talk about Sartre going to Mars, like, one rule would be don't send Sartre, don't send French continental philosophers to space.
No introverts, no misanthropes, right, you can scream.
So, so if you take Biosphere, and I won't get under the weeds too much here, but, like, Biosphere was run by kind of a crazy proto-Silicon Valley type named John Allen. The people who went in were basically people John Allen thought were super cool. NASA has much more boring selection protocols. Like, you know, I really do think if you had a ship with 24 Chris Hadfields, they would probably be fine. So we know this at least to some extent because, like, nuclear subs go down for 3 to 6 months. There's not a lot of public data on psych stuff, but what is available suggests there's not, like, a higher rate of problems. That is, a lot of it's down to selection. But so there is a way to do it.
As you point out, in a city on Mars, if you're talking 24 people, you can be very selective. Yes. If you're talking about wanting to get 1 million people up there, you can't be as selective.
Absolutely. I would actually worry, you know, that you would actually get weird people, because you might get people who'd be antisocial in some way, because they are people who are willing to, you know.
Well, and at some point, it's not the people you selected. It's their kids who you might not have selected if you had the option.
Yes.
Who may be angry when they're 13 years old about growing up on Mars and not having had a choice about.
Yeah. So yes. One thing we didn't get into, like a classic thing that would come up on, like, American colonies, which obviously have a very different context because they're in a temperate forest that was dispossessed from other people, but just a lot of them were religious in nature, and often the second generation, third generation don't feel the spirit. And so they can't participate in the colony that way. So you know, I'm willing to believe the first group of people who want to settle Mars are going to be, you know, whatever psych profile may make that appropriate, but their kids are probably not going to feel that way. They're going to be a regression to the mean. And what are you going to do for them? We don't even know if they can come home if they grow up in this different gravity environment.
There seems to be, in the colonized space movement, a lot of wishful thinking, wish casting, optimism about a kind of collectivist libertarian utopia that will emerge in space. And, you know, that usually isn't what happens when there's a colony at the edge of the world, or at the edge of the solar system, or on the edge of some distant planet barely hanging on. What you get often are murderous conflicts, as you almost got in Biosphere 1 or Biosphere 2, which I didn't even know about. Yeah. I didn't heard about that. And it just seems to me like, I wouldn't want to go, and I would wonder that anybody who did want to go, it's almost as if you should draft people who don't want to go to Mars, because anybody who did want to go to Mars would be identifying themselves as somebody that you probably couldn't trust alone on Mars with other people who wanted to go to Mars.
Yeah, I think it would depend on what Mars you're sending them to. So, like, there was a big thing called Mars One about 15 years ago. I don't know if you heard of it, but it was a group in the Netherlands who wanted to pay for people to go to Mars on a one-way trip via a reality show. This comes up for us because they got, what Kelly might know, it was like 5,000 people signed up, some huge number of people signed up. So you might think people would be like, I don't want to definitely die on Mars for your reality show. But it turns out plenty of people do. So if you're at the point where there were 10 million people and there's like a Disneyland, the people who are going to be selected to go to Mars are probably fairly normalish, but not until then.
They didn't make that show, so we never got to hear somebody say, I didn't come to Mars to make friends.
There's also the camp of people who feel like when you go to space, something about space makes you better. So we're all enlightened. So there's this idea called the overview effect, where looking at, you know, for example, looking at the Earth from space gives you the wisdom of philosophers, or, you know, you don't see borders, and you hear all of these things, which, to be honest, are not true. You can see the border between North Korea and South Korea, for example. It's quite obvious. And I think ignoring those borders is not helpful either. But so you get some people who are like, well, it won't be a problem because in space we're all going to be better. Something about the magic of space. But then you get other people who are more realistic about it, but are okay with the horribleness. So, you know, for example, when we were researching babies being born in space, there were people who are like, you know, these things could be problems. There could be disabilities, but we might just have to force people to have more abortions, or we might have to change the value for what we consider is a life that we want to keep around. And essentially their argument is, you know, in a place like biosphere, you have to spend all day essentially just subsistence farming. And early on, your time is going to be so precious that you can't spend it taking care of other humans. And so they'll say things like, well, we have to let natural selection take its course. And that stuff is horrifying to me. Like, why do we want to start a backup of humanity that loses a bunch of human rights progress that we've made along the way?
That loses its humanity.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. I don't want a backup at all if that's the backup that we have, that we don't value humans.
And we don't value Earth. Like, I think part of what disturbs me about discussions of colonizing space is it lets us off the hook when it comes to taking care of the only home we have. Because we're fantasizing about alternative homes. Some people are. There are, as you write in the book, people who think that we can push off into space all manufacturing, all industry, and then Earth may become, you know, bucolic utopia, return to a more natural state, because everything that we need for life on Earth is being manufactured in space. And you identify the problem, you know, if we're going to make concrete in space, how do we get the, what is it, 3 billion pounds of concrete we need every year?
3 billion tons. I believe.
Tons.
Yeah.
3 billion tons. How do we get that back to Earth without it turning into, on its way back to Earth, the Mount Everest slamming into Central America and killing the dinosaurs, but this time it's us.
Yeah. So to be fair, I do think that the people who are saying that space will save the Earth, at least a significant percent of them really believe it. Like, they genuinely think that this is the way to protect the Earth. And when you say, well, you're giving up on Earth, they say, no, we are saving it. And I really think they believe it. I think they're wrong, and I hope the book helps convince them of that so we can focus more here. Yeah. But I do think they believe it.
One nice thing, though, I don't think there's not a huge amount of spending. So we talk about, like, space-based solar as an example, something we think is just crazy. It comes up over and over. There is money spent on it. It's not that zany of an amount. But one thing I like to point out in this discussion is the guy who inspired Jeff Bezos, a guy named Gerard K. O'Neill, who wanted to do these giant rotating space stations, he thought we would have plentiful solar energy from space. And he explicitly says in a book he wrote in the early 80s, he refers to solar photovoltaics on Earth as the solar myth. He explicitly says we shouldn't do that because it's never going to be enough. It's not going to work. We need to invest trillions in these giant orbital stations. So, you know, fortunately that he didn't get the traction he wanted. We didn't make that trade, but it was, you know, a trade he was proposing, and he would have been absolutely wrong.
Because solar doesn't work in space?
No. Just because, we can crack this open, but basically the numbers don't work. So just as a little example that you may not have thought of, you know, you would have to have these huge solar arrays. And in space, everybody says space is cold, and there's a sort of technical sense in which that's true, but it's actually very hard to dump excess heat in space because there's nothing to dump it against, right? So if you're a blacksmith and you want to cool off a sword, you don't wave it in the air, you put it in water. Even if the water is not as has low a temperature as the air, right? You need something to just push that energy against. In space, you don't do that. So if you look at the ISS, a huge part of it is radiators just to fire off heat in the in electromagnetic radiation. So just to have these giant solar panels in space facing the sun all the time, you have to have this massive radiation system. It's much more complicated than you would guess. And it has to be maintained by somebody. So just once you start looking at the numbers, it doesn't work. It is literally possible. The physics works, but the money doesn't.
Yeah, because I'm scientifically illiterate for the most part, but the James Webb Space Telescope.
Right.
Is powered by giant solar wings.
Yeah. So it absolutely does work. The problem is you have to collect all that energy and fire a microwave beam down to a receiver on Earth. And so you lose a huge amount of energy. But the bigger deal is it's just so cheap to put an extra panel up in Arizona or the Sahara or wherever. It's just the numbers don't work.
Yeah, you point out that we would have to, you know, to clean the solar panels in space, we would have to send up astronauts or complicated robots that don't exist. Whereas to clean their solar panels on your roof, you just have to send up a teenager
exactly.
with a squeegee.
There's a highly available resource.
Yeah. So I'd say you are clearly not scientifically illiterate, but to your point that the James Webb Telescope has
I'm comparatively
panels.
Scientifically illiterate talking with you.
I don't think so. But so the, you know, solar panels work when you're generating power in space that's going to be used right where you are.
Yes.
But beaming it back to Earth is when it starts to make less sense.
Okay, we should start talking about fucking again because that's what people expect from me.
Give the people what they want.
I was excited to find out about the Three Dolphin Club and then sad when you debunked the existence of the Three Dolphin Club. What allegedly was the Three Dolphin Club?
So we first heard about the Three Dolphin Club from Mary Roach, America's greatest popular science writer. She wrote a wonderful book called Packing for Mars, which is similar, but much more focused on just like the human factors in a very personal way. It's a wonderful book. So she has a part where she read a book. We ended up reading it because she wrote about it by G. Harry Stein, who was a minor space popularizer, who I think passed away in the late 90s. And he claimed he had received clandestine reports that hanky-panky had been going on in the space station, and there was what was called a Three Dolphins Club. And the visual I think you're supposed to have is that it's very hard to keep two bodies together in space, and one way you could solve that would be by having a third player. And I think the phrase he used was that the third player was pushing and pulling in the right places. And it's one of those things you hear, and you're like, okay. And then you start to think, well, what would he actually... My imagination gets faulty here as to actually what the dolphin number three is doing. Maybe you as the expert.
Actually, I can picture it, but I lost my virginity in a three way, so maybe it's easier for me. Maybe I imprinted on this really early. I can see it.
Which dolphin were you?
I was the sloppy seconds dolphin.
Sloppy seconds dolphin.
Still a fine dolphin to be.
Yeah. Okay. But so the claim was that there was this secret club, and they even had a logo. And so he said he wasn't going to reveal the source in a book he wrote in the 90s. And he passed away. And as far as we know, I don't want to say we spent too much time on this, but nobody, to my knowledge, has gone through his papers for the deep throat, if you will, of the... dolphin story.
This isn't dispositive. Like the Three Dolphin Club may exist. We just don't have the evidence that it does exist. We're in that absence of evidence stage. Right?
Yeah, absence of evidence, and you have to assume an ongoing series of space shuttle threesomes that have not come to light yet, which maybe Kelly believes. I don't know. Kelly has a dirty mind about these things.
I can believe anything about humans having sex, but I think that they also, I think that the idea was also that they were doing it in the neutral buoyancy tank, which is just a big water tank that you go in to sort of practice what it's like to be in weightlessness. So it wasn't just in space. They were learning in the neutral buoyancy tank.
That's right.
But it's important to note that the idea behind the Three Dolphins Club is that in real life, a second dolphin helps the other two dolphins, which Mary Roach helpfully points out is not actually how it works.
Dolphins are freaky, actually, if you look up dolphin sex. Dolphins are fucking...
They're fucking.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to walk into a dark alley some night and see three dolphins coming toward you. It wouldn't be good. You know, what was interesting about the three dolphin, you know, the suggestion that this was actually being done in these water tanks that simulate weightlessness was there was some official research being done into sex in space.
Right.
That's the implication if they were doing it in the tanks at NASA HQ. But one of the things you write about in the book is that there has been no research into sex in space reproduction. And maybe that's a relic of that sort of 1940s, 50s, 60s culture that the space race was really rooted in, the sex phobia and the desire on the part of the culture to solve sex by wishing it away, that sex in space isn't a problem because nobody has sex in space, because nobody in space is interested in sex because they're looking back at that big blue marble or they're doing their little experiments and they're not succumbing to base desires. And we need to factor that in and do that research. And so when I first began to read about the Three Dolphin Club in your book, I was like, oh, so somebody did do a little bit of this research into how sex might work in a weightless environment or in space, and then to find out two pages later that nobody did that work was very sad.
I think that the pragmatic quality, so we could get into the sort of history of sexism in the space programs. That's part of this too, I'm sure. But also just like, you know, when something goes badly at NASA, someone gets hauled before Congress and has to explain why money was spent on it. And so I if I were NASA administrator, there is no way I would touch anything that could even be characterized as sex in space, because you would get called before Congress and asked, why did you put the snuggle tunnel in the ISS? And you'd have to explain and you'd be in big trouble.
The Russians have been a little less squeamish. So like they set up geckos. And so that, you know, the thing about being a gecko is you can kind of stick to the wall. And so even if you're in weightlessness, you can still hold on. And that solves some of the difficulty of staying, you know, in contact with your partner.
Wait, did they send geckos up for people to have sex with? What was the gecko?
It was a
thing
gecko
about?
Harem. It was like one male gecko surrounded by hopefully willing lady geckos, but in a little box, I guess, right? It was like a single satellite.
So tell us the geckos in space story, Kelly.
So from what I remember is that, you know, they went up to space. I think we got some video of them having sex. So I think that that worked. So maybe we should be looking to like sticky hands instead of the snuggle tunnel. But then they lost connection for a while and that was really sad. And then I think we got connection back and everybody was really excited. And then they burned up in the atmosphere. Or they froze.
I think they did both. I think they died, they froze to death, and then burned up in the atmosphere in a glorious, hopefully in a good position on the way down. I don't know.
But what a way to go.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
That's right.
Mark Kelly is a former astronaut, current U.S. senator, and I was surprised to learn that he is the person who has confirmed jacking off in space.
No, that was Scott Kelly, his brother.
Yes, his brother is the space masturbator.
I'm sorry.
Yes, but also, just to be clear, he said, I plead the fifth. So he's highly incriminated as a space masturbator.
Oh, he was definitely masturbating. Come on, man.
He was up there for a year, right?
A year.
Yeah.
All right.
A man
yeah.
has needs, and the geckos were dead.
I just wish you would elaborate, because it would be... So the way the toilet works in space is there's basically two vacuum heads. One for number one and one for number two. So there is like a kind of like aim aspect. But they do have wet wipes. So who knows? Would you bring a sock into the?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, obviously. Well, what do you do with it? Do you put it in the laundry stowage after it? I mean,
you put it in the trash. It gets burned in the atmosphere.
How fast does it move? Human ejaculate. People on Earth, men on Earth, ejaculators on Earth sometimes brag about shooting over their head or hitting the
board. I can't answer that question. So the rocket equation, I promise not to put math into this, but to just simply say it, the rocket equation, it's the governing physical principle for rockets. It says the faster you fire mass away from an object, the more oomph it gets as a rocket. So physically, if you did, you would get shot in the other direction, and you could actually calculate it using the rocket equation. So if someone listening wants to...
What?
Well, okay, but here's the thing. So almost certainly not enough to be noticeable compared to, like, the random motion. So I remember from Mary Roach's book, she asked some astronaut... I'm sorry to... I guess this is the right show for this. Whether flatulence will propel you according to the rocket equation. And he said he tried, and there was no noticeable effect. So, you know, maybe there's some guy out there who could get himself across the space station by this means. I doubt it, but someone can run the numbers.
Have you ever female ejaculation? I have seen female ejaculation. That could send someone flying across.
All the more reason for more women.
There's so much more force.
You know, so when we were doing most of our sources on particular, there is a book on sex in space. Other than that, it was like you're just finding what you can, where you can find in memoirs and things. And I looked high and low for any woman ever mentioning any sex, anything, and nobody mentioned anything, very tragically.
Although folks like Mike Mullane argue that the erections when you wake up are much stronger.
It stands to reason that, you know, if your erectile chambers are filling with blood and there's no atmospheric pressure working against that.
That's a good point.
That perhaps your erections would be noticeably
stronger. That's an interesting question because the spacesuit has lower pressure. I hadn't even thought about that. It's like being in a giant penis pump. Who knows? I've heard nothing about erections in a spacesuit.
Okay. I know, like, you're being really generous with your time. You're fancy New York Times best-selling authors, and you have science things to do. But nobody gets off this show without having to take a sex question with me, yes. So I've got one for you, if that's all right.
Let's do it.
Hey, Dan. Bye, lady in her 30s here. My poly group is fairly new to the lifestyle. We're talking like 8 months. And last night I just got a message from my metamor's boyfriend asking to come hang out because we'd all done a little bit of group play. And I have a suspicion that this guy hasn't let my metamor know that he's reached out to me and done the emotional work with her to gauge her comfortability. And I'm trying to find out if, you know, he has in fact had a conversation with her. What is my move if he hasn't? Do I use that opportunity to educate him? He's probably the least poly-educated out of all of us. I think he, up until very recently, is identified as monogamous. Do I take the opportunity to educate him on how I think it would be reasonable to navigate when you have a crush on somebody else and you want to get with them? Or should I reach out to her and kind of give her a heads up so she doesn't feel blindsided? I feel like that could still create drama. I really just don't want her finding out about this way later and, you know, being upset that she wasn't kept in the loop.
All right, Kelly, I'm an advocate for non-monogamy. I'm an advocate for polyamory. But I think in space, only monogamous people, only pairs that we can't risk with everything that could go wrong on Mars, can't risk polydrama.
I think only poly, because, so, all right, so say you have a bunch of monogamous couples up there and one of them breaks up. Now you've got two people who have no other options for sex, and they could be starting, you know, they could be starting drama. They're probably lonely. Whereas if you've got, you know, a poly community, then, you know, you can switch. Like, if you're stuck 2 years with the same person, just one, I can see things going wrong.
I want to hear your congressional testimony for the, we must.
They must be poly. Everybody must be fucking everybody. We've got to send daisy chains into space.
Oh my
I guess
God.
You're right. Like, if, you know, you send up only monogamous couples and a couple breaks up, as couples do, then those two people become free agents or chaos agents, potentially trying to get with, break up other couples so that they can get laid again, unless they want to be the dolphin number three over and over and over.
That's right.
Well, or they're just grumpy and, you know, kind of sad and lonely, seeing everybody else being happy for however long they're stuck there with no other options. You know, they could be a chaos, either breaking people up or a chaos just as like a sort of sad person who's bringing the mood down.
As a poly person myself, or a person in poly relationships, kind of backed into polyamory, I don't like to think of myself as a poly evangelist. It requires a lot of communication and a lot of processing. And isn't everybody on Mars going to be too busy for that shit? For Google calendars and
Like the scheduling problem.
Table polyamory meetings and scheduled. Like, people are going to have basic survival
oh my God.
To worry about.
I love the idea of Mission Control being like, it's time for your 2 hour relationship discussion.
But you also need joy. And you know, everyone's lives are going to be scheduled to the minute detail anyway. And I feel like if you have a community that's really good at communicating, that's going to be important in an environment like Mars.
Okay. All right. So this caller and her polycule, let's send them to space to figure this out.
I wouldn't do that to anyone.
They'll have to work it out or they'll die.
Do you have any advice for them? Now you've got to give sex advice to this caller.
This is outside my area of expertise as a serial monogamist. But I think my relationships that worked best were the ones where I was honest with everyone. And so I think maybe you should have conversations with both of the people where you're wondering if everybody has the right amount of information, but just try to be, you know, you don't want to make it seem like they're being scolded for not knowing what they're doing, but just kind of try to have an upbeat conversation and get everyone on the same page. But again, this is not my area of expertise. I don't know. How is that advice?
That was pretty good.
Okay.
Zach, you want to take a whack at it?
I am an awkward person who should not be trusted to give personal advice on anyone's life for any reason. So I'll just defer to Kelly.
He's right. Yeah.
You know, what I think is interesting is that the caller, you know, heard from this guy and now thinks she has some awesome responsibility here. Mm-hmm. I think she just needs to kick it back to him. Have you asked your girlfriend? Does your girlfriend know? Because if she does, that's great. If she doesn't, you need to talk to her and then circle back to me. You can wash your hands of this, caller. This is not on you. It's on him. And if he doesn't realize it's on him, just put it on him and then wait and see what the fuck happens. That would be my how to avoid drama advice. Also, don't go to Mars.
Yes, don't go to Mars.
And Kelly, I think I agree with you that maybe monogamy would be too risky on the red planet to attempt. But man, polycules, particularly polycules, sorry to say it, that involve a lot of opposite sex couple pairings and couplings and throuplings and repairings and depairings. I wouldn't feel comfortable being on that Mars mission with the large, sprawling, mixed-sex polycule myself.
Well, in an ideal world, we would be able to bring everyone, and we'd all be able to make the same choices we could make here on Earth. But we can dream of that future.
This is my science literacy. There was an experiment many years ago on, oh my God, some kind of fly, some very simple fly, where they did identify a gay gene, where if they flipped that gene, flipped that switch, the flies, tsetse flies, I think, would all the men would mate with each other. And what was interesting about how the behavior changed was the newly gay tsetse flies just wound up in a heap, all of them madly fucking. they didn't pair off like they did when they were little straight tsetse flies. And I think that if we do send polycules to space, they should be gay ones.
Yeah.
Because everyone will be like the tsetse flies, just madly humping each other, and nobody will ever be left out or feel excluded because you can just jump it to the other end of the pile.
It's a beautiful vision.
That's a future I can get behind or in the middle of or anywhere. Yeah.
You would need a very big snuggle tunnel to accommodate
That's
the
right.
gay
oh my
poly
God.
Family that you sent to space.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book. Or I can, I just did. I enjoyed the book so much.
Thank you.
And it was really fun, a fun read. You describe it as popular science, and it is in the best vein of popular science writing. Zach, your illustrations and cartoons are hilarious. And it did illuminate so much about what would actually have to happen for Elon Musk to be the king of Mars. And so I'm no longer worried about Elon Musk being the king of Mars.
Good.
Kelly Wienersmith, Zach Wienersmith, authors of the New York Times bestselling book, A City on Mars, Can We Settle Space? Should We Settle Space? And Have We Really Thought This Through? They always say that if there's a question mark at the end of a headline or a subtitle, the answer is no. And the book is clear. The book is about how we have not thought this through. You guys think it through and think it through hilariously in A City on Mars. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed chatting with you. It was a real honor.
So excited.
This was
here.
So much fun. Thank you. Yeah, the honor's ours.
All right. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Kelly Wienersmith and Zach Wienersmith, authors of A City on Mars. The book is a terrific and very entertaining and informative read, and I recommend it. And it would make a great gift if there's somebody on your list you haven't gotten a gift for yet. Get them. A City on Mars. This has been Sex and Politics. It's a special bonus podcast for Savage Lovecast Magnum subscribers, and this installment, of course, a special gift for our micro Savage Lovecast listeners. Have a happy holidays, everybody. Thank you for being a Magnum sub. If you're a Magnum sub, thank you for being a micro listener. If you're a micro listener, and if you're tempted to become a Magnum sub after hearing my conversation with Kelly and Zach, head on over to savage.love and become a subscriber now.